The following is a teaching by Dr. Ken Boa from the Leadership Series on the subject of integrity.
If you had to pick out one topic, a topic about leadership, a quality or a feature of leaders that you most admire, what might that be? If you were looking for someone with whom you wanted to work or someone you wanted to put a deal together with?
Integrity.
Interesting. I didn't think you were going to just give it to me that easily. I figured we were going to kind of work our way around and finally come to integrity. It's the number one topic. We've been looking at a variety of leadership qualities. As some of you know, I was involved in the Leadership Bible, and we came up with 43 qualities of leadership in three major categories: personal development, skill development, and relational development. And under personal development, what we've looked at so far are the qualities of character, commitment, courage, dependence on God, and humility. But today we hone in on the issue of integrity. And I'd like us to turn to 1 Samuel 12, verses 1 to 4, because Samuel's farewell speech is an illustration of a man who sought to walk in integrity, and I believe manifested that. In his farewell speech in 1 Samuel 12, 1, he said to all Israel, "I have listened to everything you said to me and set a king over you. Now you have a king as your leader. As for me, I'm old and gray, and my sons are here with you. I've been your leader from my youth until this day. Here I stand, testify against me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkeys have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I have done any of these things, I will make it right." "You have not cheated or oppressed us," they replied. "You have not taken anything from anyone's hand." It's an interesting thing that Samuel, at the end of his judgeship, would ask the people to review his leadership and ask them to say, "If there's anything I have done, I'll write it now." It's a rather strong statement here, where he held himself accountable to the people he led. And if we think about this quality of integrity, the fact is that people want assurance that their leader can be trusted. They want to know that that person will keep promises and follow through on commitments. Promises and commitments are significant, and sometimes in our day, it seems that those are optional. As long as it's convenient for us, then we'll continue to do that. But when going gets tough, we have this mindset that somehow the rules can be changed and somehow we can renege on our commitments and our covenants. This concept, by the way, of covenant is a very important one in Scripture. Throughout the Scriptures, God focuses on the fact that He is a God who makes and keeps covenant, that He can be trusted in His Word and His promises. And it always comes down to the issue of your character, and not just in your words, but also in your works, in your lips, but also in your lives. I think that the real issue of integrity is a consistency. And if I had to summarize what I mean by integrity, I would use the word consistency between what is inside and what is outside. That there is a congruency, that what the person claims and how the person lives is congruent, or at least moving in that direction, that there is a movement toward a consistency between belief and behavior, and between our words and our ways, between our attitudes and our actions, between our values and our practice. And so if I think about this discrepancy between what people claim to live and how they actually live, the thing that I first go to, and whenever we study these characters in the Leadership Bible, we always started with God, and that's what I want to do right now. You always start with your vision of God. Integrity in who God is the foundation for everything else. Because if you start with God, that gives us the absolute unchanging foundation for understanding how then we should be. Because who He is then should then be reflected in who we are, and then who we are should be reflected in what we say and how we live. And so it always comes and starts with the unchanging character of the living God. And I want to stress that. Changeless character. Immutability, the theologians call it. He does not change. Of course, Hebrews 13:8 is a verse that relates to this. Jesus Christ the same, yesterday, today, yes, and forever. Jesus doesn't change. The living God does not change, thus his covenant love is always dependable. This is the fundamental thing. What can I lean against? What can I trust in? What can I pursue with reckless abandon? So many of us have been burned by relationships, by people, by people reneging on their word, by claiming that they said something and they didn't say it, or that they didn't say something and they did, any number of things like that, and almost makes you cynical if you weren't careful. But when we come back to the character of God, we realize there's the unchanging standard. I think about some verses along these lines that tell us that we can hope in his promises. And in Hebrews, earlier in Hebrews, it tells us about this fact that we can trust in the living God because his promises don't change. And I think about this issue of hope. And in Hebrews chapter 6, it tells us that God doesn't lie and his promises are good. And thus he can say, we have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where Jesus, who went before us, has entered in our behalf. We have an unchanging standard then. Or in James chapter 5, verse 12, remember he says, let your yes be yes and your no, no. We discovered when we were kids that often what our parents said was yes was really not yes, or the no was not no. Remember that, how that worked? And so a kid could, they'd say no and just kind of wheedle and control, kind of, and eventually they'll turn it into yes or the other way around, or if you promised, remember that idea here? So kids are legalists. I mean, if they can, if they just kind of get a little bit of a hint that sounds remotely like a promise, then they've nailed you. And so they'll want to hold you to that promise. But the disappointment of a kid who's been told that by the father that he'll be there for the game or whatever it might be, and then discovering, yeah, I said I was going to do that. But, you know, the whole thing, if that becomes a pattern, I understand it from time to time, but there are patterns that emerge. It's the same thing in relationships with one another. There are times when I'm late for meetings or meeting a person for an appointment, but if I make that a regular habit, you need to tell me that, you know, and I've had people who've done that very thing. When it becomes really something that's customary, after a while, your claims don't have a lot of merit anymore. In other words, after a while, one excuse is fine, but a pattern of excuses begins to become inconsistent. And so our claim ought to be consistent with our character. In 1 Samuel 15:29, put it this way, he who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Again, the contrast between God and man. We change our mind, but God does not, in the sense that he says something and he will do it. And by the way, thus there is no possibility of manipulating God or of bribing God or of bargaining with him, because he'll never compromise his perfect integrity. In Malachi 3:6, it says, I, the Lord, do not change. And so if I contrast his unchanging character with the changeable, the mutable character of people, I have to realize, who am I going to trust at the end of the day? I'm going to put my trust or my hope in something. And I'd be prudent if I hope in God's character, because it will not let me down. And his promises flow out of his character. And because his character is consistent, his promises are trustworthy. I'd like us to turn to Isaiah chapter 6 for another text. This has to do with integrity and who I am. We see who God is. Now, how do we fit in this role? This is one of the best known texts from Isaiah. It's that passage about Isaiah's confrontation or being confronted by the power and the glory of the living God. Isaiah chapter 6. When God reveals himself to Isaiah in this vision, where he's about to be commissioning Isaiah as his servant, as a prophet, it says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Woe to me, I cried, for I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin is atoned for. And then God says, he hears this voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send and who will go for us? And I said, Here am I, send me. And then he gives them the prophetic commission. He said, Go and tell this people. And then he gives the word that he's going to tell them. Powerful image, is it not? What we have is an image of the holiness of God. And that holiness of God is such that the prophet's response is one of what? How would you describe his response to the unutterable holiness? You heard the threefold statement, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. That image that we often hear in the liturgy. A part of the idea of the Sanctus.
He's kind of devastated.
He's devastated. What else? You might say he's disintegrated. I'm undone. I'm torn apart, which is just the opposite of integrity. It's the idea of to have integrity is to be integrated, to be whole, to have it all together in a sense, to be consistent. Here he finds himself torn apart in a sense. And suddenly he realizes the deficiency. And what is he aware of most clearly?
His own unclean
lips. He's aware that he is an unclean person in the midst of a holy God. It's interesting, the encounters with God are very consistent in this way. Can you give me another example of such an encounter with the holiness of God where a person is overwhelmed and that's the same response? A similar response.
Depart from me.
Yes, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man. Who said that?
Peter,
you recall? What had just happened in Peter's situation? Do you remember with the fish there? And he knows that's not the way it works. He's a fisherman. The boat was like a floating seminary. Every time something happened there, they learned something about Jesus. You know, that's kind of what it was. But, you know, he says, this is not the way it's done. He knew he had an authority and a power over the natural forces that cannot be accounted for. But instead of saying, how did you do that? What did he say? Depart from me, I'm an unclean man. So he's aware, not just of power, but of holiness. In fact, the incarnation of holiness. By the way, this is what people are seeking to avoid when they do not know Jesus Christ. They're seeking to avoid the trauma of holiness and God's incredible personal, as a personal ultimate. That's why it would be great to plumb for some sort of impersonal force, maybe, if you're a New Ager. But at the moment you say that ultimate reality is a person, now you have a moral and righteous dimension that must be dealt with. And in fact, you have the issue of accountability. I believe people don't want to deal with that issue of accountability. So there's a trauma of holiness. Another example of that?
You know, I think about even when Jesus was about to be taken captive.
Yeah. Robert's referring to John 18, where when they were going to, they came with 600 people. It was a cohort armed with clubs and spears and so forth. And he said, Whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, Ego eimi. He said, I am. And when therefore he said, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. 600 soldiers. And the word that's used for that is one in which they were kind of held there, pinned to the ground. He could have walked over them. I don't know exactly what happened, but I have a suspicion that the veil of his flesh, somehow the pre-incarnate glory that he had before the foundation of the world was opened up for a microsecond, and it was sufficient to overwhelm them. But then he, in humility, allowed them to take him away. What's an example of Christ's unveiled nature that you have another encounter similar to the one we've been describing?
John
on the island of Patmos. You recall when he had a revelation of Jesus Christ, and it describes in Revelation chapter 1 his glorious image, his appearance, which was overwhelming. And when John, therefore, saw Jesus in his resurrected glory, what was the result? he fell down and he was like a dead man. And Jesus had to basically touch him, raise him up. That was the feel that he had. He was overwhelmed by that holiness. This is the same John who would lean on Jesus' breast at the upper room discourse, and he would often lean on him. He would often sit next to him. There was an intimate fellowship and a closeness, but when he saw that holiness, he was overwhelmed. So there is this picture of God's utter holiness, but there is also this other side in Scripture of his closeness to us, that somehow we can have this relationship. Jesus, the mediator between God and man, makes it possible for us now not to be consumed by his awesome holiness, but actually to be declared, and this is the amazing thing, righteous. That the living God could say, you are righteous, is an amazing concept when you think about it. How is that possible? It's because Christ himself is in us. Conversion of Paul's another example. Moses' encounter there with the burning bush. Joshua before the captain of the living hosts. Daniel when he's overwhelmed in chapter 10 there by the vision of the angel. All these images are found through Scripture. I'm suggesting here that when we are encountering, when we live before God, before the heart of God, as the phrase is, coram Deo, when we live before him and practice his presence, we realize that being people of who do not manifest integrity is not consistent with the dignity and destiny that we've been called to be. We've been called to be better than that because now Christ is in us, and he wants us to manifest in who we are what he is. Now, that's not possible unless he dwells in us, but therein lies the solution. In fact, that's the genius of the Christian life. Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship, as it's often said. It's not about a bunch of rules and regulations. Instead, it is the presence of and power of a person who indwells us. So Christianity, then, is not just a thing that we think about or believe in, but it's a person that you trust in and now who lives in you, in fact, indeed, wants to live through you. And thus you practice his presence. When we think about integrity, we think of its opposite. And what was Jesus reserved his harshest words for whom? The Pharisees. Matthew 23 is the classic passage about hypocrisy. And again in Matthew 23, he would say, "Woe to you," and he would call them hypocrites. Seven woes that he gives them. And so he would repeat this almost like a litany. For example, in verse 13, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are." Strong words, I'd say. When we think about the humble teacher from Nazareth, better think again here. There's an authority and a power that he chose to confront forces of hypocrisy. His biggest enemy, of course, was that which posed to be followers of the covenant. And actually, religious hypocrisy was was the greatest thing of all that he chided because of the inconsistency and because it misrepresents the person of God. I would like to make a suggestion about this image. When we think about the word integrity, other words come to mind. We think about the word ethics. We think about the word morality. How do you distinguish ethics, morality, and integrity? How would you draw a distinction there? Because they are really somewhat different, each of those three words. Ethics, morality, integrity. Ethics is doing what's right, even when no one's looking. Morality connects with values. There's a very real connection there. We've just talked a little bit about integrity. Let me suggest a few additions to this. I'd like to think of ethics as a defined standard. That is to say, it's what you claim to be right and wrong, good and evil. It's what the Pharisees said that they believed was right in that case. In other words, that would be your defined standard of right and wrong. It's what you think is, it is your value system that you claim to, that you want to embrace. This is what you say is right and wrong, good and evil. Whereas morality, I would like you to think of as a lived standard. Ethics has to do with what you claim is right. Morality is how you live. In other words, it's the way you live out right and wrong, good and evil. It's what the Pharisees actually did. And integrity, if that's true, would be the extent to which your ethic and your morality are integrated. So integrity would mean then that to the extent that a person's ethics and moralities tie together, they have integrity. To the extent that there's an inconsistency, they lack it. Let's look at this in another way. If John tells you that he's going to lie, cheat, and steal from you, he has a low ethic. If he does, in fact, lie, steal, and cheat, he's at least got integrity. You see what I'm doing? It may not be a great thing, but at least the guy is consistent. You've seen this among, for example, in the mafia. It's a very interesting thing, their values here. They have a particular standard. One of the things that you don't do, you don't what? What are some of the things you... Yeah. You don't squeal, for example. That's one of the rules there. And frankly, there's probably a high degree of integrity along that category when you're dealing with the mafia. You see the point here? Considering the consequences, that is, you don't want to sleep with the fishes. So, however it works, there's at least a congruency there. It seems to work. My point here is that another person might claim to have that standard and then he doesn't live it out, a good standard. And the other way around as well. There are some people who live maybe in some regards perhaps better than their own image of themselves. My point is that it's important for us to have both a high ethic but also a high morality, and it's that consistency. So if I want to lead, I owe it to prospective followers at least to let them know where I'm, what they're getting into, one way or the other. I want you to notice from this long text on the Pharisees, God's real displeasure with those who say and fail to do, that it's something we need to realize. He takes this business seriously. And in our lives, which frankly is a kind of a frightening word, and that's why I'm going to 1 Timothy chapter 4, because there's another dimension to this. There is a progress. In this life, you never attain perfection, but the desired movement is one of progressing toward the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. You never attain, but the idea is that there's supposed to be something of a progress there. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, Paul tells Timothy, be diligent in these matters, give yourselves wholly to them, so that everyone may see your progress. Watch your life and doctrine. Note the connection there. What did he just say? Watch what? Your life and doctrine. That is to say, your works and your words, your life and your lips, your belief and your behavior. Put those together, in other words. Watch those closely. Persevere in them, because if you do, you will save both yourselves and your hearers. So clearly then, we want to talk about a person here who not only talks a good game, but who also plays by the rules. And what a leader does, I believe, has a far greater impact than what that leader necessarily says. We'll often forget what a person may say, but we'll remember what they do. And so there is this way of making of communicating this. And many of us remember the go-go days of the real estate market in the 80s. And we know, and I've run into people and new people who would talk the talk, and they would say, you know, my desire is to integrate Christian principles and the way I do deals and put things together and so forth. We often heard that. You know, and when things were really flush, it really was a nice thing to say, and they felt good about themselves in saying that. I'm thinking about a couple of people in another state there, and both of those people made the same kind of a claim. When things fell apart, one guy actually skipped town and left the others holding the bag. Another guy, when his empire fell apart, actually, in that pain, worked out an arrangement whereby he would ultimately pay back his investors. Slowly but surely, he would seek to do that. And that was an indication of his integrity, that his willingness to then be a man of integrity and a man of his word at the end of the day became a significant thing, to at least find a way of returning that. We have such men in this room. And the fact is that that is, when it comes down to money, isn't it something that money brings out the reality in us? When it comes to financial matters, you really discover what a man is made of. It's a nice thing to talk pious words and talk about how I seek to run my business on Christian principles. But then when it comes down to a deal where you realize you made a commitment and now you've realized it may not have been to your advantage, where the psalmist says he swears to his hurt, that's when you discover really this issue of integrity. It's a question of committing yourself and going through with a thing because you made that claim. I'd say the key, the operant word we've been talking about in this last text, though, is the word progress. I think we all find ourselves stumbling in many ways, but if our desire is to progress toward that integration of our claims and our lives in terms of the way we live, I think we're moving in the right direction. As for myself, I have to ask myself, how do I live when no one's looking? And so I want to be a person of consistency. When no one sees, am I seeking to practice his presence? And frankly, the fidelity or the spirituality of small things is a big issue here. That is to say, it's not going to be in the big things that you really discover your mettle, but actually it's going to be in the small, small things. The way you treat people with dignity, the way you show integrity and care to them, the way you seek to practice his presence and be a person who's ruthless with the way you evaluate yourself and understand that God's grace is such that he can change you and move you in this direction, so that the ultimate sense is that we become at the end what our desires make us. So if you really, what you desire, you become like that. And you become a person who reveals that what you really desire in the way you live your life. At the same time, the more you practice his presence or the more you move in that direction, the more you discover, woe to me, I'm undone. But then, and this is the important thing, that must be coupled by an increased understanding of grace. So your increased self-awareness must be coupled by clinging to the reality, though, that even though I feel undone, I am not undone because he has made me whole. And thus what happens is my grasp of grace increases, because I begin to realize how far down he really did reach. But the fact is that he also lifted me up. So I don't want to play worm theology on the one hand, but on the other hand, I don't want to have an inflated view of myself. So there's a tension there where, in my view, the great saints seem to be most aware of their own shortfalling, but also most aware of God's love and God's grace. So those two, I think, work together.
Can you have a difference between professional integrity and personal integrity?
Yeah, I for me, find it difficult to draw any kind of distinction between professional and personal integrity. I think in a professional way, if that's not being matched in my personal life, there's a lack of credibility, a lack of authority. Because true authority comes from that consistency. When a person walks with a proper character, that gives credibility and authority to what he claims. And eventually, that discrepancy, though, if there is there, will become revealed. It'll come out eventually. You cannot live that life and get away with it, I think, consistently.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org. The following is a teaching by Dr. Ken Boa from the Leadership Series on the subject of integrity, Part 2.
This morning I want to talk about an incredibly significant theme, namely integrity. Integrity as a component of leadership in terms of the person of the leader. The thing that people look for more than anything else, if we really consider that, is the whole assurance that the leader can be trusted and to mean what he says and say what he means. And integrity has to do with a congruence between the inside and the outside. Namely, that there is a consistency of fit between what a person professes to be when people are observing and what the person actually is when no one is seeing. And so this is an issue of congruity of integrity. Now, there are some people, certain criminals, for example, who have tremendous integrity. They don't claim to have any good values, and they prove it. And so there's a way in which integrity by itself doesn't mean virtue, but at least it means inside-out consistency. Some people are just consistently bad outside and inside in some regards. But the point is that there are a lot of people, and Jesus reserved his harshest words for such people, whom he called hypocrites, hypocrites, who had a mask. And actually that word hypocrite comes from the idea of a persona or a mask that would be worn in Greek comedies and tragedies. And so that you put the mask over your face, you wouldn't see the real person. And that became a persona, and where we got the word face. And so it would be an outward appearance. But sometimes it wouldn't really fit with the inward reality. I want you to turn to 1 Samuel, particularly chapter 12, as a central passage on this theme of integrity, because frankly, concepts are always easier to understand when they are modeled. And the scriptures provide us with a variety of models of the various qualities of integrity. And when I spoke about integrity, I used Samuel as an example. And I want us to look at the life of Samuel briefly, just a little bit further than I did before. Because in ancient Israel, godly leaders really were often hard to find. And in those days, it describes how in Samuel's time, the word from the Lord was a rare occurrence. Very few people really were given the prophetic gift. And Samuel was one who was dedicated even from his mother's womb when Hannah, his mother, prayed for a child and her prayer would be granted. And Eli told her this. And she dedicated the child so that when he was weaned, she brought him to the temple and there gave him to God. And ultimately, God more than made up for that by opening her womb and giving her other sons and daughters. But this child then was dedicated and he lived there in the temple with Eli, the high priest. And through the years, he observed men and women and he observed their worship to God. And he understood the concept of Israel being very, very central in the purposes and plans of the living God. Now, one of the defining moments in his life occurred when he was a very young child, and he heard word from the Lord, Samuel, Samuel, and three times he didn't understand that until the third time he finally came to Eli, and Eli discerned it must be God speaking to him. And Samuel received a message as a young boy that was a message he did not want to reveal to Eli because it was a message of condemnation. And Eli said, "Tell me the whole message." And he did not hold back. And it was a message really of judgment about Eli and his two sons. And indeed, the three of them would in fact die in the same day as a result of Eli's failure really to discipline his children, but also in his failure to allow the temple to be what it needed to be, set apart for God's holiness. And this was a hard thing, but even at that young age, you see the rigors of leadership are already being developed in Samuel as a young boy, because part of leadership is the integrity of honesty and of sometimes the need for confrontation. And in this context here, we have a situation where Samuel really has that level of character that's consistent with this high and holy calling of being a prophet before the Lord. It says in 1 Samuel, going back to 1 Samuel chapter 3 for a moment, the Lord was with Samuel, verse 19, as he grew up, and he let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba recognized that Samuel was attested as a prophet of the Lord. The Lord continued to appear at Shiloh, and there he revealed himself to Samuel through his word, and Samuel's word came to all Israel. So he had a clear public recognition. He also served as Israel's judge, and in chapter 7, verses 15 to 17, it says, Samuel continued as judge over Israel all the days of his life. From year to year he went on a circuit from Bethel to Gilgal to Mizpah. judging Israel in all those places. But he always went back to Ramah, where his home was, and there he also judged Israel, and he built an altar there to the Lord. I find this interesting. He was the first circuit judge. He actually went on a circuit every year, and he would go around, and what he would always do then is ultimately return to his home in Ramah, and he'd use that as his base of operations. A central point of reference provides stability for other venues. And then it describes how, near the end of his life, something significant took place. When the people clamored for a king, Samuel confronted the people. Before I mention that particular text in chapter 12, I want to say that Samuel is also known to be a kingmaker, but also a kingbreaker. He had the tragic experience of having to denounce Saul, the man whom he had anointed as Israel's first king, and he had to denounce him because of his disobedience and his failure to follow through with what God has clearly mandated him to do. And as a consequence, he had to challenge him and actually tell the king, your kingdom will not endure because you have not kept the Lord's command. So he had to confront this man of power, which is a risky bit to do. As you know, prophets always took risks when they confronted people in positions of power and authority, because often they would not respond in any kind of godly manner, as you can imagine. In fact, Samuel would also be given the task of having to anoint the next king, David. This time, not a man who was impressive in appearance, as Saul was. He was head and shoulder above all the other men of Israel. But rather, he would be guided to a man who would be actually a young man, ruddy of appearance, not as impressive as Saul, but a man who would follow God with a whole heart. And the issue is what's inside, not what's outside, that determines true leadership. So he would anoint him as king. Samuel's view of leadership, by the way, is shown in his protest over Israel's demand for a king. You see, all the other people wanted a visible monarch, just like all the other nations. But it was a theocracy where God ruled through the governing judges. And ultimately, the people themselves rebelled against their own judges and clamored for a king, just like all the other nations. And Samuel warned them, this is what the king, if you want a king, will do. He will take your sons and make them serve. He'll take your daughters. He'll take the best of your fields, he warned them. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage, your men servants and maid servants, and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves, he told them in chapter 8. Nevertheless, the people said, we will have a king. Interesting, though, I want you to note the contrast between this description of the conduct of Israel's kings, and he was right, with Samuel, who actually was a man who was, I would call, a model of a servant leader, who warned the dangers of a leadership that defines itself by privilege and power and lives off the efforts of those who are led. That is always the abuse of power that's so evident in our times and, frankly, is not new to our own culture, but is evident really throughout the history of the planet. Samuel's a great leader because he understood leadership as an opportunity to serve people, to add quality to their lives. And he abhorred leadership then that manipulated and used power to exploit and used it only for personal gain, for reputation, for aggrandizement. He saw its leadership instead as a stewardship, an honor and a responsibility and a privilege. And thus he demonstrated integrity. It was not his... He did not become have integrity because he tried to be have integrity. He was honest because his intention was not to be known as an honest man. He had integrity because his intention was not to be known as a man of integrity. He was fair and just because he wasn't thinking about developing his reputation as an honest and fair man. He did all those things because he was thinking about honoring God and serving his people. The others were byproducts. You catch the idea? If you pursue the gifts of God, for example, the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, what are the others? Peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. You pursue those things and then as ends in themselves, you really won't find them. They are actually the byproduct of the pursuit of God above all else. When you pursue Him, His gifts are thrown in. Pursue even honesty and integrity as an end in itself so you'll be recognized as a man of honesty and integrity and you'll never really achieve them. Pursue God above all and you'll find those will be thrown in along with the lot. Does that make sense to you? It's a risky thing to do though because you're pursuing the invisible over the visible. because you're pursuing the approval of God over the approval of men. And that's a risky thing to do in our culture because you're valuing and treasuring the unseen as above the seen. And thus we have this risk of obedience that's always required. And so as I see a man in Samuel's stature, I see him at the end of his journey as he tells the people near the end. He says, now, he said, you have a king over you. He'd anointed the king, and God said, they have not rejected you, they've rejected me from being their king. Nevertheless, do as they say. And he anointed Saul. Then in his farewell speech to Israel, chapter 12, he said to all Israel, gathered them, I have listened to everything you said to me, and I've set a king over you. Now you have a king as your leader. As for me, I am old and gray, and my sons are here with you. I have been your leader from my youth until this day. Here I stand. Sounds like Luther. Testify against me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkeys have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I have done any of these things, I will make it right. You have not cheated or oppressed us, they said. You have not taken anything from anyone's hand. Samuel said to them, the Lord is witness against you, and also his anointed is witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand. He is witness, they said. Why is this so important? Notice, by the way, how long he had served them, since he was a youth until his old age. A long journey. And the significant thing is that he could ask those challenging questions and not have anyone question that and say, no, you didn't do this, or in that occasion, you did wrong. He said, he could say, I lived with integrity before you because I was seeking the pleasure and honor of the living God. Every leader decides those accomplishments or values for which he or she wants to be remembered. For some, it might be their decision-making genius. For others, it might be the amount of money they were able to amass, and for others, the degree to which their followers loved or respected them. But here, he reveals that his true treasure was integrity before the people because he was an honorer of the living God. And this is an important concept that I want you to see. In verses 5 to 7, then he talks about this very theme and charges the people and says, verse 7, now then, stand here, because I'm going to confront you with evidence before the Lord as to all the righteous acts performed by the Lord for you and your fathers. Now what he does, instead of looking at himself, he looks at God's acts of integrity toward the people and what they've done. And he demonstrates to them that they have actually acted with treachery by denying God. They are convicted of their sin. And they say to Samuel in verse 19, pray to the Lord your God for your servants so that we will not die, for we have added to all our other sins the evil of asking for a king. They were convicted by the evil of their actions. Then Samuel said, do not be afraid. Samuel replied, you have done all this evil. He doesn't play it down. Yet do not turn away from the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. Do not turn away after useless idols. They can do you no good, nor can they rescue you, because they are useless. For the sake of his great name, the Lord will not reject his people, because the Lord was pleased to make you his own. As for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you. That's a very important verse. Far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you. Intercessory prayer is an important privilege and responsibility. And I will teach you the way that is good and right. But be sure to fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with your heart, all your heart. Consider what great things he has done for you. Yet if you persist in doing evil, both you and your king will be swept away. God is not impressed by what impresses people. Your king can come and he will go if he does not honor me. God's not impressed by the things that impress us. So it's a powerful word of exhortation to these people, that they are called to really obey and to serve the living God. And I want us to develop that same perspective that keeps us on track. A perspective that will keep you on track is to walk before the Lord your God and not to seek to impress people. Again, remember, the idea is the audience to whom you play will determine your true character. If you play to an audience of men, to a visible audience, you will be a person who has a persona, all right, an image, a public image. But you could also be a hypocrites, a hypocrite, who manifests one behavior when people are looking and another when no one is there. And so this is, in fact, this is my clever segue to Matthew chapter 6, because indeed there Jesus speaks about those hypocrites, the hypocrites. As we turn to Matthew chapter 6, Jesus, part of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, what we see here, the whole chapter really bristles with this concept of integrity before God. That what we see in Matthew chapter 6 is that integrity requires a great deal more than a commitment to itself. Hey, there are a lot of New Year's resolutions that we've made. How many of us have made resolutions at the beginning of the year? Oh, I'm going to do better this job on this and so forth. We often say those things. We have near scrapes with all sorts of things. And we really want to kind of focus our mind and close our eyes and say, I'll live more consistently by my principles. And then we slip up again. The fact is, though, that we want to look at what Jesus says about this matter, and I want you to look at verse 1 of chapter 6 to be an illustration of this. Be careful, Jesus says, concerning this matter, not to do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen by him, by them. I want you to notice, integrity is going to be determined by the audience to which you play. If you want to be a man of God, you will play to the right audience. If you play to an audience of men, how will you have integrity? You'll be, again, a person who knows that you can be one person when they see and another when they do not see. Only the living God sees you when no one looks and knows what you're doing at all times. And so the issue is that you will be shaped by the audience to which you play at the end of the day. So he says, don't seek to impress men. You'll have no reward from your Father in heaven. And so he tells them, really, that you can do the right things for the wrong reasons. Things such as even trying to develop integrity because it'll advance your career. So it's an ironic bit, this matter of integrity. If you're doing it just because it's a good add-on and it impresses people, it really will put you in a position of being a hypocrite. He uses the word three times in this passage. Verse 2, he talks about the hypocrites. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the street to be honored by men. I tell you the truth, they have received the reward, present tense in full. There's no reward for them in heaven. And then he says the same thing again in verse 5 when he says, and when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on street corners to be seen by men. I tell you the truth, they have received the reward, present tense, in full. You want to play, your reward will be shaped by the audience to which you play. You play to an audience of men, that's all you're going to get. So that it's like the deal about the rodeo, the guy, he didn't do very well. He says, give him a hand, folks. He says, that's all he's going to take from this rodeo. You want to get something better than that. You want to go for a prize that will endure, not the empty plaudits of men that will pass away and be forgotten in the sands of time. You want to pursue that which will endure and pursue the one that before whom you will really stand in the end and give an account. Then again, he says the same thing in verse 16. First, he's talked about the whole idea of giving, alms. Then he talks about prayer. A third thing, fasting. All these three things are good when you fast. He didn't say if you fast. He says when you fast, and we're not going to go into fasting, but it's an important discipline that we often overlook in our time. Do not look somber as the hypocrites do. They disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. They know that they make themselves look intentionally miserable. Oh, what a godly man. He's a man of God. After all, look at him fast. He's suffering. I tell you the truth, they have received, present tense, actually past tense, they have received their reward in full. And so Jesus gives these invectives and says, don't seek to impress people. They're just seeking to do that when people are watching. And to be frank with you, how excited would you to be doing business with men who are just people who put on a persona, a face, when people are watching, but they're another person when no one is watching. You see, that's called public dependent behavior. And there are a lot of people whose behavior is one thing when people are watching and another in private. And Jesus says, I'm more concerned about the way you are in your private thoughts and acts and words than when people are watching. It's easy to give a pretense without having the reality. We can be very good hypocrites. It comes from the Greek theater, so you put a mask on, and we can. The scary thing is, you can wear that mask so long that it becomes cemented to your face. Then you can't take the thing off, and you become the persona that you embraced. That's a scary moment. There's a moment, I think, of no return in some men's lives, and God alone knows when that moment will be. But you can only play that game so long, and then it becomes cemented to your face, and you become the person you pretended to be. And there's no depth, no reality, no integrity before you. Something of power is lost. Your Ichabod, the glory is departed. That's a scary thought. So the essence of hypocrisy, which is lack of integrity, is public dependent behavior. And so when I see Jesus suggests what he tells us to do, look at verse 4. He says, So when you give to the needy, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. It's a very powerful image. So that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father who sees what's done in secret will reward you. Don't do it to impress people. And then he says again in verse 6 it is, yeah. But when you pray, go into your room. Close the door and pray to your Father who's unseen. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. You see this idea here that there is an integrity. Look at verse 16 when it talks about fasting. When you fast, don't look somber as the hypocrites do. They disfigure their faces. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face. In other words, don't make it look like you're fasting, so that no one would know. So it will not be obvious to men that you're fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. You play to an audience of one. He's an invisible audience. What he's saying here in this context is don't do these deeds to be impressed. But he says, let the things that you do, though, the quality of your life be manifest, not because you're seeking to be rewarded, but your light is evident to others, that you don't cover it up, but it's evidence to other people. Not to draw attention to yourself, because in this context, he's talking about drawing attention to yourself. In that context, he's talking about allowing the light of God to become manifest in other lives. So there the issue is intentionality, and there's a difference in one's intention. By the way, intention really means a good deal more than just the actions. You have to understand that. Jesus always says the deeper and more profound level is your intention, not your actions. A lot of people can do good actions or appearing. That's what he's talking about. It's the intention of the heart, and only God knows your heart. That's why you can't even there be sure about another man's intentions. Frankly, I don't even know my own motives, not fully. It scares me. I've often told you, I'm not sure if I've ever had an absolutely unsullied motive in my life. If I have, the moment I became aware of it was gone. So it's kind of a scary thing. You can't trust yourself. Don't trust yourself. There's only one to trust. So don't pursue public dependent behavior. In fact, Jesus goes on to talk about play to the audience of one, to the living God. You don't play to an audience of many, but to an audience of one. And there, when you play before the invisible God, you will be a man of integrity because he sees when no one else sees. And then he talks about reward. Look at verses 19 through 21 in the same context. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So the things that you treasure in the end is where your heart will be. So may I say that integrity then really means living by one standard and for the approval of one judge. You're not seeking to impress people, but to be pleasing to Christ. People come and go, and their standards will always be fickle. But ultimately, you're seeking to please Christ, and then he's the unchanging, always present one in your life. I want you to turn to Psalm 32, rather, because here's the thing. I've just given you a high standard, haven't I? How on earth can we live this? Here's the problem. The scriptures are realistic enough to tell you God knows your frame, He's mindful that we're but dust, and He's mindful that we will stumble in many ways. Isn't that the true statement? What do you do then if you seek integrity and you stumble and you screw up? That's what Psalm 32 is all about. Psalm 32, as like Psalm 51, is a psalm of penitence. God Himself referred to David as a man who walked in integrity of heart. The word is used in 1 Kings 9:4, whose heart was fully devoted to the Lord his God in 1 Kings 11:4, and who followed the Lord completely. So clearly his psalms teach obedience to God, but how can he be a model of integrity? You recall the incident with Bathsheba alone is enough to blow him out of the water, you'd say. And yet God still honored him. Why? Because David was a man who turned to God when he was convicted. He consistently held to the same standard. And when he wrote about that standard, he meant it. So thus, when he violated that standard, he did not make excuses or treat it lightly. He turned to God ultimately in conviction of his heart for forgiveness. That's a very important point here. Integrity doesn't demand perfection. Please understand this. God does not expect perfection out of you. He alone is perfect. He desires, though, that we turn to Him when we stumble, because we all stumble in many ways, the Scriptures tell us. Integrity doesn't guarantee a perfect life, but it requires an integrated life. Here's the point. If you live with integrity, you'll have a moral center that'll integrate your behavior. There's a moral center. There is some object of an attraction, the divine attractor. And when we violate that moral center, we'll recognize that violation. We'll call it what the Scriptures call it, sin. And we'll treat it as an aberration. We'll confess it. We'll honestly confess before God and others. We'll make restitution if necessary. We'll seek forgiveness and reconfirm the standard. In doing so, then, what happens is that the sin itself and God's forgiveness is not an excuse for a lack of integrity. But because we are men of integrity, we turn to God and He restores us and we proceed on. Does that make sense, that idea? So even there, the Scriptures tell us how, even when we stumble, we can still maintain the context of true integrity. As I wrap it up, then, I want us to finish with one last text, and it's also from David. In this case, it's David's prayer of praise to God because of the people's generosity in giving as they're planning to build the great temple that David himself won't be privileged to build. His son Solomon will build it because David himself, having been a man of bloodshed, would not have that particular privilege. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, he knew that he again emphasizes that God's pleased with integrity. And this is a powerful passage when he says, "Yours, O Lord, 1 Chronicles 29:11, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the majesty and the splendor, for everything in heaven and earth is yours. Yours, O Lord, is the kingdom, and you are exalted as head over all." Notice this next verse. "Wealth and honor come from our hard labor." Is that what he said?
No.
It comes actually ultimately from you. A man can work extremely hard, and one man can be blessed in his labors and another man can work hard. But if God chooses to withdraw, he will not really have that. And he can give you and he can take it away. It ultimately comes from him. So he says, "You're the ruler of all things. In your hands are strength and power to exalt and give strength to all." He goes on to say, "Everything comes from you," verse 14. "And we have given you only what comes from your hand." Do you notice that attitude? They've just brought money to Jerusalem, to David. They've brought money to build a temple. And they've given that money, but they acknowledge that wasn't ours. It came from you. And all we're doing is just symbolically giving back to you what you've given to us. Thus, David says in verse 17, "I know, my God, that you test the heart and are pleased with integrity." I want to read and close with this word from Richard Baxter, a 17th century Puritan writer who spoke on the importance of integrity and wrote a book called The Reformed Pastor. And in that book, The Reformed Pastor, he's telling men who have taken on the call to be men of leadership, spiritual leadership, here's the kind of lifestyle you need to lead. And so he tells his readers, and now these are pastors themselves and men of God, "Take heed to yourselves," he warns these men. lest your example contradict your doctrine, and lest you lay such stumbling blocks before the blind as may be the occasions of their ruin. Lest you unsay with your lives what you say with your tongues and be the greatest hinderers of the success of your own labors. It much hindereth our work when other men are all the week long contradicting to poor people in private that which we have been speaking to them from the word of God in public. He says it's bad enough when people don't do what we tell them to do from the pulpit. He says it's a good deal worse, though, if you do the following. It will much more hinder your work if you contradict yourselves, talking again to pastors, and if your actions give your tongue the lie, and if you build up an hour or two with your mouths, and all the week pull down with your hands. Isn't that a powerful image? You build up with your mouths a couple of hours. It's easy to preach to the congregation. You see, when you point one finger to others, though, three are pointing back to you. That's the problem here. And so he says, it's easy to preach, but you can pull it down with your hands. He that means as he speaks will surely do as he speaks. So again, there is this appeal to be a man of integrity. What are you like when no one sees? You can justify your external behavior, but God looks at the internal motive. So again, integrity is what drives your heart. Your actions will be determined by your heart, but have integrity before God. It's the audience to whom you play.
Only God knows that.
And so the issue is, who is the audience to which I play? It's not in my place, nor does the Scripture give me any particular mandate or warrant for me to say it's wrong for you to let people know or not. Although there are although having said that, he just said, don't let your right hand know what their left is doing. So you have to, but how you do that is going to be a question of your own convictions before God. And you, what you have to deal with is the intention or the motive of our heart. You see the idea here? So it's really down to the question. And by the way, that's where you get down to the level of convictions. And I think that that's, there are differences between convictions and commands along those lines. And so what one man may have convictions that can govern his behavior that another person may choose not to exercise. The whole issue is really the focus of his heart. And but I'll tell you this, for myself, I need some spiritual margin. May I give you an example of this again? I've given you this example before. I have certain convictions that I will pursue, even though they're not commands. You know the difference then. A command is something clearly given in Scripture, positive or negative. A conviction is something you choose to do. It's a thought-out resolution between yourself and God that governs your behavior. You have to revisit that. One of my convictions is if I'm traveling by myself, which I rarely do, if Karen's not joining me, I usually bring a guy or some other men with me, which I enjoy because of the fellowship. But if I happen to be by myself, one of my convictions is I never turn on the TV in the motel or hotel room. The reason, not because TV is wrong, it's because I'm afraid that I will catch something and no one's looking, you see, but there is someone looking. So I'm not saying that it's wrong to turn on the TV, but for me, I know that why put myself in harm's way? There's no risk if I don't turn on. That's only a conviction between myself and God. It's not a command. You don't need to do that. You just have to determine in your own life what your convictions are and review those boundaries from time to time. Because what that's doing, it's like Stone Mountain. Remember I've given you this example before? They put the fence there way before you're likely to fall when you go to the top. But you can go over that fence and you can walk away and there'll be one step too many. And you won't be able to see it because the gradient is not obvious. You see my point there? So a conviction is a boundary that you determine between yourself and God that governs your behavior.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.